And now, a bit of romance.
Two girls on a quest to find which rom-com is the best. P.S. I love rom-coms.
I love rom-coms.
Hello, and welcome to P.S. I Love Rom-Coms, the podcast about quirky lady ghosts, annoying co-workers who boast, and Mark Ruffalo, who is just the most. We're your hosts. I'm Allie.
And I'm Mia. P.S. I Love Rom-Coms is a review podcast where each week, Allie and I try to answer the question, which rom-com is the best rom-com of all time? And boy, do we wish that a magical pink flyer with the answer would just land into our hands.
Would be so sweet. Now, we like to start off each episode with a little segment called Which Rom-Com Hero / Heroine Are You Channeling? Where we equate the experiences we've had this week with the famous rom-com hero or heroine. And I can start us off this week. This week, I am channeling Andy Anderson from the rom-com How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. most specifically, Andy's work life in the movie. Andy, you know, has these kind of dreams of writing these like really like in-depth articles that like expose social injustices in the world. And her boss, Lana Jong, played by Bebe Neuwirth, kind of puts Andy in her place. And it's like, actually, Andy, this is what you're going to write. These puff pieces. And why I'm channeling Andy is today I had an audition, and now that things are starting to open up again, it was an in-person audition. Yeah. And it was one where it was like I was paired with like a partner, like a stranger I'd never met before. And we were supposed to be a married couple in a tent. And animals were attacking us in our tent. You know, just a typical Monday. So, yeah, in this audition, me and this stranger have to pretend that we're camping and being attacked by animals. The casting director gives us a little bit of a rundown. It's pretty basic audition. We're just supposed to, you know, look in certain directions and look scared. Easy peasy. I go back out in the lobby with my partner, and he like, I try to sit down, and then he like waves me over to a corner to sit next to him. And he goes, I don't like that direction that the casting director gave. And I was like, no. Okay. And he was like, I think we need to be true to the script that was written. And just so you guys know, the scripts that are written for commercials, because it was a commercial audition, are very bare bones. It's usually half a page. And he like went through this whole backstory, and he like was like, first we're going to look right, and we're going to see a skunk attack us, and it's going to smell bad. And so pretend like it smells bad. And then we're going to look left, and it's a coyote, and we're scared. But we know that coyotes, to like ward them off, you have to make noise. So we're going to scream and clap our hands.
Oh,
and then
my God.
The third animal that's going to attack us is a bear. And we're just going to pretend still like we're trees. And so he just is telling me how to do my job, Mia.
Oh, my God. And I want to die.
I wanted to die. I literally shut down, and he like was able to see that I wasn't totally like on board. And he was like, tell me, how long have you been in the industry for?
Oh,
and
my God.
10 years.
Oh, my God.
And he's like, okay, so about the same time as me. And then it was just oh my God, this is just. And so,
this is like a, it's like a painful, dark sketch.
It's
of like
so
an actor in LA.
Bad, Mia.
Oh my God. It hurts. It hurts my chest to hear this.
It what was happened? Crazy.
What happened in the room?
We went in the room, and he was like really just like in the lobby bragging about his experience. He like moved to China to act in films. And then he was like, I was in so many films in China. Everybody knew who I was. And I was like, okay, cool. He's like, there are no American, you know, white Caucasian male actors in China. So I was like able to book a lot of parts. And I was like, I didn't ask to hear all of this. And then we were back in the room to do the audition. And truly one of the worst actors I have ever worked with. And he made all these crazy decisions. And I just kind of did my own thing. And I ignored him. And I bet he'll book it. So,
oh my God.
But yeah, so it's just like nothing like somebody telling you how to do your job and you know they're wrong and you know you can do better, but you're just kind of in a weird situation where you have to like listen to them.
I've been there and it is so horrible.
Because it's
so
also horrible. One of those things where you're like, what am I supposed to do? Be like, yeah. No. It's like,
yeah.
It's just someone who's making it so hard. And then the fact that it's a commercial, it's like, it would be funny if I was like, it would be fun. It is objectively funny, but because it's our life, it's not.
It's
objectively comedy that someone is doing this at a commercial audition where it's like the premise is like, you know, it's like you get up, you drive across town. They're asking you to do something that's sort of like mildly humiliating. And then he's like, this is what we're going to do. We're not going to listen to the casting director.
Yeah. And it's like, that's literally the like main point of our job is to listen to the casting director. And so, yeah. But you know what? Why I'm lucky, though, is, you know, it's not this is a perk about not having a 9-to-5 job. I don't have to see that guy again. And I don't have to work with him again unless we both book the commercial, which
could you imagine?
Well, could you imagine? the good thing is I don't have to see him again. I don't have to work with him again. And people who have 9-to-5 jobs and you are stuck with those difficult coworkers, I'm sorry. And I wish you patience and good luck out there.
Yeah,
but that's
luck.
Who I'm channeling. Mia, yeah. Who are you channeling this week?
This week, I'm once again channeling Peter Renner from Forgetting Sarah Marshall. This time with a twist. there's like a montage where after his breakup, Peter sort of like goes on a dating, sort of sleeping with people like montage. And it's like he's getting back out there. He's having fun. And then it sort of like ends with him crying because he's just sort of like not ready. And it's just like a lot. And I feel that way socially right now after sort of like 2 years largely inside, largely like keeping to myself, spending time with my dog. Right now feels like a moment where things are really open. You know, we're between surges. high population of vaccinated people. So things are like really opening back up. And I was really like, you know what? My life's kind of getting into more of a groove. I was like, yeah, I'm going to get back out there. I had like a sort of like a very big social week. And I was like, this is going to be great. I had like 2 birthday parties, an improv show, a bachelorette party, and then like a handful of individual hangs.
Oh my God.
Like, yeah. And I was like, you know what would be a great idea is if I did all of this. And I am like more fatigued than I've ever been in my entire life. I'm like, if I ever see another human again, it'll be too soon. I'm ready to like go back inside and like not see anybody but my dog for like another 2 years. Like it was just too much too soon, man. I'm just like, I don't have the social stamina I once had. I don't know how to talk to people. On like the tail end of this was like a night where, and honestly, thank God, it just feels like others feel this too, at least.
Yeah.
Where like one of the nights was just like, people were just being a lot of like, there was a lot of like, are you happy? A lot of like, well, you know, we lost the last 2 years and we're all adjusting. Just like a lot of that talk where I was just like, okay, everyone is, we're like collectively coming to terms with what has happened. Just like Peter is coming to terms with his breakup. So that's who I'm channeling. And I'm happy and I'm grateful and I feel happy to be here socializing with people.
Yeah.
But I am overstretched. I overdid it.
I'm
ready to be alone inside for a few weeks. That's how I feel.
That makes sense. It's exhausting. And I find myself in these like, this new kind of like, you know, kind of, you know, calm period that we're in right now. Like when I'm hanging out with people, I ask the question, and I know not to ask this question, but it's literally the only question you can ask, which is, how have you been? what have you been up to? And it's such a cool question, because how the fuck do any of us answer that? And so then quickly, what I've been doing is, as soon as I ask that question of like, what have you been up to? I follow with answering for myself, where I go, I've been watching the TV show blank. And then instead, we just get to talk about TV, which feels safe, because honestly, that is what most of us have been doing. So one of the few activities that was afforded to all of us during the pandemic. Oh, so.
Allie, that's so smart. It's a safe equalizer. It didn't necessarily change. But yes, okay, so that is such a smart way to pivot that conversation and handle socializing. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pick safe topics and I'm going to do that. And that's what we're going to do from now on. Oh, yeah. But speaking of not remembering how you did things in your life before a big event, let's get into our movie discussion, shall we?
That was so good.
Wow. She's back. Thank God. Okay.
She's back. Ladies and gentlemen.
This week, we watched the 2005 rom-com Just Like Heaven. In this film, David, played by Mark Ruffalo, a recently widowed landscape architect, moves into a new apartment in San Francisco. But he soon discovers the apartment isn't entirely empty. It's haunted by the ghost of a woman named Elizabeth, played by Reese Witherspoon. And although Elizabeth can't remember much about her life, she's convinced that she isn't really dead. As David and Elizabeth try to get to the bottom of her identity and why she's a ghost, they begin to fall in love.
Oh, of course. Just Like Heaven was written by Peter Tolan and Leslie Dixon and directed by Mark Waters. And fun fact, co-screenwriter Leslie Dixon suggested using the apartment where she used to live for shooting. Oh my God. She also, I know, right? And that apartment is so gorgeous.
Beautiful.
She also suggested John Heder for the role of Daryl. And both of these suggestions were taken.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, yeah, wait, yeah. That's so cool. Wow. Wow. Writer with a little bit of sway in Hollywood.
Also, an incredible apartment. I was like, wow. An apartment like that in San Francisco, cha-ching. But maybe it was, I guess it was in 2005. So it was a different time, but still.
Right.
That's, nice apartment. Yeah,
so nice. And also, it's so funny because they spend so much time talking about the apartment. That's very funny that it's like she's just fixated on her old apartment.
Yeah, and how
so much about the apartment. I mean, like, how lucky it is.
Yeah, truly, like, one of their first bonding moments, Elizabeth and David, is like, David goes like, this is a really nice apartment. And Elizabeth, like, looks over at him like, huh, he really does have something kind of nice about him. Like, you see her thinking that thought, and it's like, yeah. It's really just screenwriter Leslie Dixon patting herself on the back, being like,
yeah, I had a great apartment.
Have you seen this film before? And what were your broad thoughts on it?
Oh, yes, I have seen this film before. Yeah, I saw this film in theaters in 2005 at the Tigard Regal Cinemas, where I saw many a rom-com in the early aughts. And I loved this film then. I thought it was like so whimsical and interesting. Also, I was very young, so I just took it very literally, and I haven't seen it since then. So it was very fun to watch it again in 2022 as a full grown adult and be like, wow, a lot of the stuff happening in this movie is crazy. But I remember it felt very sort of like grounded in to me back then. And now I'm like, oh yeah, this is like sort of a dream logic, like very like simple film. But I loved it. I think it's very simple. I love like a rom-com with like a nice touch of magical realism. Mm-hmm, I think it's very fun conceit. Ghost who's in a coma. I don't see that a lot. I love The Cure. So I really enjoyed music. Yeah, and ultimately, no, I had a very fun time watching this. I adore Reese Witherspoon and Mark Ruffalo. And it took me back to a simple time in rom-com where it didn't feel like gauche, it didn't feel overdone. Mm-hmm. It felt like it represents a time in the genre where like it was big budgets, big releases, trying new things, big stars, but didn't feel rote. It still felt specific and unique. Yeah. What about you? Had you seen this before?
Yeah, I've seen this once before. I think in college during my big rom-com phase. And yeah, watching it again after, you know, being immersed in rom-coms for the last couple of years, I thought that, yeah, this film was very well done and well executed. Like, it was, like you said, there's a lot of like magical realism and like rom-com logic in it, but it's, you know, using rom-com logic that we know and love, like the, you know, the old destiny kind of trope where it's like, oh, you know, they were supposed to meet on this blind date before this tragic accident happened. And then it just so happens that David is looking for an apartment. And then this pink flyer, seemingly by magic or just by the San Franciscan winds, rips from a billboard or bulletin board, floats through the wind and hits him in the face. And he's, it's Elizabeth's apartment. Ah, how perfect. The woman he was supposed to go on the blind date with. I love it. I love all of it. It's very fun that she's like a ghost. What a great kind of obstacle to keep them separated. Yes. It's like, oh, we can't really be together until, you know, we figure out if your story, why you're a ghost. And then when they find out, oh, she's not dead, she's just in a coma. Another fun twist of how do we get her spirit and her body reconnected? And then triple twist, her spirit and body are reconnected and she doesn't remember David. So good. I remember the first time I watched that movie and that third twist happened where she didn't remember David. I was like, this is genius. This is so sad. Oh my God. This is the worst ending fake out of all time.
Exactly. It was so rough.
And yeah, I think that it's just really cute. Both Mark Ruffalo and Reese are just really cute people. And I loved it. That being said, I will say I have a personal strange relationship with the song Just Like Heaven.
Oh my God, what is it?
Just because. Oh my God, Mia, it's dark. Not that dark. So the first boyfriend that I ever had who I loved, Mia, oh my God, I thought was like, he and I are gonna get married and it's true love. Before he broke up with me, he played the song Just Like Heaven. Don't know why. I don't know if he's being dramatic or what, but he's like played this song. And he's like, isn't this song so good? And then he broke up with me right after. So whenever I hear the song, Just Like Heaven from The Cure, I think about our breakup. And, you know, some couples have songs and this is our breakup song.
Fuck, that is crazy. How old were you guys?
Oh gosh, 20.
Wow, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. That's crazy.
We were still like, it's pretty young. Old enough that it's, you know, still kind of, you know, teenager-y.
You can't play a Cure song out of context and then break up with somebody. That's crazy to me. That's crazy. But you know what? Wow. And also The Cure is such like a moody, evocative band. I'm so sorry that he tainted that song.
Yeah. And you know, right after our breakup, I listened to Just Like Heaven just 50 times in a row, trying to pick it apart, being like, are there clues in here? Are there clues of why he wanted to break up with me? And the reason why he wanted to break up with me is he was a 20-year-old boy. So not ready for a relationship. But here I am looking for subtext in a Cure song. But yeah, so every time I hear that song, I'm always like flashback to my college apartment. But yeah, really like this movie.
great film. Picked a hard song for our alley girl, but how dare. But we'll see by the end of the podcast, so maybe we can get a new connotation with the song so that it's yours again and not this person's.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. I will say the thing that you brought up something, which is like the logic of the film, which is, I feel like that's the biggest difference, which is like in almost the 20-year span in which I have not seen it, that has shifted, where I remember when I was very young and I saw it and they were like, that's why I can talk to you. We were supposed to meet. And like, I just know if you touched me, I would wake up. Like these things that like, I feel like are now that feels like aged to me. Like the logic is so, there's like, I feel like there's no justification for why that's true. Like, I love it. But I just remember at the time when I was younger being like, of course. They were supposed to talk to me.
Fantasy logic where it's like we're destined to be together kind of a thing where it's like my unfinished business, it's like the true love's kiss kind of, you know,
right,
justification of things.
So that's so sad or interesting that now that I've gotten older I'm sort of like, I don't know about that
because like, I've had a couple of true love's kisses and you know nothing's
sort of like
my reality stayed pretty much the same.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, I don't know if that would sort of be the reason, but it but I also really value and appreciate the simplicity of it. Like, I do think that's very nice as well.
Yeah, it does feel very like childlike logic, fairy tale like logic.
Right. And treated so seriously, which is something I do miss about that era, where I feel like it is just these two like very skilled actors just being like, or when she was like, he's a landscape architect. He takes Ghost Reese Witherspoon to a garden he created. And she was like, I've been here in a dream. And she like starts the movie in a dream in the garden.
Yeah.
And then the movie ends with him like recreating the garden on her rooftop. Yeah. And I remember like that all made a lot more sense to me when I was a kid. I was like, now I'm sort of like, okay, I don't even know how those things are connected at this point.
There's a lot of magic in this movie, and there's like this one line that kind of like tries to justify it a little bit, where they're like, Mark Ruffalo's or David and Elizabeth are in the hospital room where Elizabeth is in a coma, and David goes, you know, Elizabeth, you can't always trust machines. It's like,
oh my God.
Sometimes, he doesn't say this, but the subtext is like, sometimes miracles happen. And it's like, okay.
I am shocked at how much that logic has changed.
Yeah.
Since this movie came out.
Yeah. That being said, like, there was like other like solid logic. I mean, like my favorite part of this movie is when it kind of turned into like a detective story almost. Mm-hmm. Like my favorite part is like when David and Elizabeth are doing like detective work to try to figure out who Elizabeth is. And you see them like coming together and trying to like figure, like going through her drawers, finding clues. Cause it's like my two favorite like genres combined, mystery and rom-coms. And so I was like, heck yeah. They're like digging through drawers, getting clues.
Going to houses,
knocking on doors, asking questions.
The dry cleaners, there's a red herring. Oh my God. And then did you notice that like they go to the first place where it's like, oh my God, did she have an affair with this old orange dog?
Yes.
And it's like, no, her coworker lived next door. They were like at the wrong house or something.
Because they misread, because she's a doctor and doctors have bad handwriting. She read it as a 5, but it was really a 6. And and it's such a good kind of perfect sexy circumstance, you know, using the word perfect kind of in a weird sense because she is in a coma and a ghost, but like it is a fun sexy circumstance for them to come together and get to know each other as them solving this mystery.
Yes. No, totally agreed. I really enjoyed that aspect of it too, where it like sets them on this like very fun chase where then even when they're like get to like the restaurant where the man,
oh my God.
I mean, I don't know what that medical procedure was, but she sort of like walks him through. And then is that when she realizes she was a doctor?
Yes.
Like that's very fun. I also really enjoyed that part. You're so right where it does kind of combine like yeah. rom-com fantasy mystery in a very fun way.
Yeah. And in those scenes where you see like, they do this thing throughout the movie where, in some shots you'll see Mark Ruffalo talking to, Reese Witherspoon's ghost or Elizabeth's ghost. And then they'll cut away and then they'll cut back and you'll see Mark Ruffalo's character, David, just talking to thin air. And you kind of see him through the perspective of everyone around him. And it's like, this guy looks crazy. He's talking to himself. And what was a little fun fact for you, the director, Mark Waters, would have Mark Ruffalo put a little earpiece in and would have Reese feed her lines directly into his ear. So it created a more realistic effect of him responding to her. And so it looked a little bit more realistic. So a little fun fact.
That's a great idea because it did feel seamless to me when she would disappear. That's so interesting. I didn't know that's how they did that. That that I think did add to it because it does look so good when it's just Mark. And then also, oh my God, shocking. Roger Ebert gave this film a favorable review.
No, he didn't.
He did. He liked
it. No, he would hate this kind of movie. I know.
I was shocked. He gave it 3 stars. He liked it.
What?
And he said it was sort of like that Reese Witherspoon and Mark Ruffalo were lovable. And he also liked the dialogue. And he brought up this line that I actually like loved when they're in that park scene where she's sort of like disappearing and coming back. When she was like, okay, like you should, she was like, well, let's consider the 2 options. Like either I am a ghost who's talking to you or you're alone. You're a crazy person talking to yourself alone on a park bench right now. And I guess he liked it. And I was like, oh my God, that line did stand out to me too.
Yeah.
As like a very fun.
It was a good justification for why David would be doing these things. It's like, yeah, well, if I don't find out, you know, if she's real or not, then I'm a crazy person. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, I'm going to go on this journey with her to find out if I'm insane or not. Wow. You know what I do remember though about Roger Ebert is that he likes Reese Witherspoon a lot.
You're so right. He's like, he really constantly, like, you're sweet. Right.
And of course he's right. She's incredible. But yeah, he also really likes Sweet Home Alabama.
Yeah, you're so right. He's a Reese Witherspoon fan. Yeah. And that's what his title was. It was like, he just likes Mark Ruffalo and Reese Witherspoon. I also really appreciate it. I thought the humor in this movie was very funny when they have, I'm so sorry. His name is not Napoleon Dynamite.
It's John Heder.
John Heder. Yes. When I love like John Heder as the medium who can see her and he's like very casual, like they have like a series of mediums, come in to like try to like deal with the presence, and
it's like a medium montage almost.
Yeah, kind of like a montage of bad dates but for mediums, of it not working. And then they have John Heder come in who's like the least likely to be successful, and I just thought that take on it was also very funny, and I that kind of like held up his element of it. I was like, that's very funny to me.
You want to hear something crazy? And please. This is also kind of sad. And it's not like a phenomenon that happens so much anymore, but definitely happened, I feel like, a lot in like the late 90s, early 2000s, where these really dark rumors would go around that celebrities were dead. and really, it was just like they just hadn't had work in a little bit.
That's so messed up.
remember there was like one that was like Steve from Blue's Clues was dead. And then there was
Cal from Keenan and Kel
was dead. And there was one about, I remember this one, that John Heder from Napoleon Dynamite was dead because there are these people that had like this one kind of success and then, you know, they didn't book a job right away. And everybody thought that they were dead because they weren't working, which is so dark because it's like, if you're an actor who's not working, you're just good as dead. But now thanks to Instagram and social media, you know, everybody,
we know
who's alive and who's not. But when this movie came out, it confirmed for a lot of people that John Heder was still alive, because that rumor had gone around and it was like, oh no, he is alive. Look, he's in this movie.
Oh my God. That is so sad.
So sad. But yeah, this was one of his first movies, right after Napoleon Dynamite. Well, not right after, because there was a long enough gap that people thought he was dead.
Wow. That's wow. And then how fitting that he's then like a medium for the undead. But yeah, I did. I enjoyed him in the film.
I was sort of like,
and because he was kind of like more well known for Napoleon Dynamite, like more of like a moment, I was kind of like, his part won't be funny. And I was like, no, I really like that side character. I think he's funny.
Yeah. And we saw him in other rom-com, When in Rome. Remember, he played the magician in that.
Oh my God. Yes. He had a little renaissance of rom-coms.
He did.
Oh my God. This movie also is like very heavy to a certain extent, where there's like a whole element of the plot is that Reese Witherspoon's character's in a coma and that her sister's going to take her off life support.
Yeah.
I was like, that is like very heavy. Like, I don't remember that being so heavy. Watching it back this time, I was like, this is really intense content.
And it was, what's really dark is you watch Reese Witherspoon's character, Elizabeth, watch her sister decide to take her off life support. And she's like, please don't take me off life support. But her sister can't hear her because she's a ghost. And so it's very dark. And how do you face your sister after that? And, you know, obviously Elizabeth's sister was like, I'm just doing Elizabeth's wishes. But yeah, it is very dark. And I forgot about that moment as well.
Go ahead. No, I was going to be like, and it's like another like logic thing where she's like, my niece can see me. And then she leaves and she's like, is Aunt, what's her name?
Elizabeth.
Yeah. Is Aunt Elizabeth going to like have more tea with us? It's like, yeah, the logic was just very whimsical and magical.
That some people were touched with the gift. Like John Heder's character, Daryl, was touched with a gift and could sense.
And the niece, Lily, and Mark Ruffalo. Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to say about, since we're talking about like hospital stuff, is the opening of this movie where we see Elizabeth, who's like a really busy businesswoman, but she's a busy doctor woman. She's like working a crazy 26-hour shift, is so like fun and stressful, and like it made me want to rewatch Grey's Anatomy, because I was like, oh yeah, it's like kind of like this like romanticizing of like the hustle, instead of, you know, actually being a commentary on like overworked hospitals, hospital workers. But but it was like this kind of like, she's like eating salads and falling asleep and like always pushing the button of the coffee machine, and like
and she's and just like cares about her patients, you know,
cares, like, really cares. And she's like doing stitches and, you know, cutting, using that scalpel. And it's very fun.
I mean, I'll watch. I miss the age of television. I mean, I'm sure it still is this way, but I miss like believing that's how doctors were, where it's like, they're just like, I will stop at nothing until my patients feel great.
Versus when I go to the doctor, I feel like a burden, where it's just
they
like,
are just like, I got to be out of here in 20 minutes. They're like, I'm sorry, my best guess. And they're like, yeah. So I agree. I miss that whimsical, magical realism of like the doctor who cares.
And there are doctors who care out there. We know. But also, doctor. My doctor's tired and she needs a break. And I'm sure she's overworked. But
exactly. Yeah. And it's very hard to schedule through my health insurance. So it's just, it's just different. It's just a different place out of your reality. But I love to see it in a rom-com. Please put more.
Yeah, more rom-com doctor offices.
Yeah, passionate doctors. But Al, any final thoughts before we head to tropes?
Well, what I'll say is, I loved the apartment where they shot a lot of stuff. Oh, so beautiful. I will say, though, anytime they went onto the rooftop, it really bothered me because I could just tell it was green screen. I don't know if you felt that way, Mia. Yeah, the lighting would get really like really soft, like super, super soft and orange and hazy, where I'm like, oh my gosh, is there horrific pollution in the air? Why is the light so orange like this? I've only seen the sky this orange when there are horrible wildfires here in California. So that was just a little like a little bit like, ugh, like a little too rom-com-y world for me. Just the bad soft lighting. It made me be like, do I need to put on my glasses? Oh, wait, I'm already wearing them.
No, I agree. And I read that that garden was CGI as well, like the one he makes in the end. So
you can tell. You can tell. I would say, though, too, it was fun that they chose to set this in San Francisco instead of New York. I thought it was kind of like a fun change of pace, and that they do a good job kind of like honoring San Francisco with like the trolley cars and the beautiful architecture that they have there, those kind of like brightly colored apartment buildings and whatnot. And so, and they go to that, like, that famous park in San Francisco. I've been to it. I don't remember what it's called.
Yeah.
There's a really good ice cream place at the bottom of it that I've been to. I thought that was a fun choice and a fun change of pace. What about you, Mia? Yeah. Any final thoughts?
No, you know what? I think this is a very fun rom-com. I enjoy it. It's very simple. Looking back, I'm like, oh my gosh, some of that logic seems like very heightened now. But I really appreciate a big budget twist on the genre, and it was really nice to go back and watch it. And of course, I just think the two leads are fantastic. So I enjoyed it. I had a lovely time in this world.
Nice.
And all right, we like to end our movie discussions by counting up all of the familiar rom-com tropes we spotted. I will start us off. We mentioned this. We got a busy businesswoman. she's walking down. She's like, you got a UTI. I need an EKG. You know, we're going through all the specifics. She's been on the clock for 26 hours. And then we've got a laid back guy and an uptight woman. You know, have you heard of a coaster? You know, us women are always thinking about coasters.
And so don't drink so much. Eat a vegetable.
Yeah, it's like, okay, we get it. Hot mess BFF. I thought the therapist friend was like kind of a hot mess BFF.
Oh yeah.
We have a meet cute where she appears as a ghost in his apartment. And we have a crosstown chase where he's got to go steal her body before they cut off life support. Oh, yeah. So a real morbid twist on the crosstown chase. Quirky jobs. He's a landscape architect. So
architect. You know. Architect of plants.
And doctor. Yeah, just specific. Architect of plants. And a doctor. Huge ass apartment. I feel like the apartment's the third character in the film. We spent a lot of time talking about that fantastic apartment. And then the oversexed lady is bad. We have like a neighbor. Yeah. And we don't like her, which is just a trope we see sometimes where it's like the lady in the film who wants to have sex. Well, she's a bad one. But you know what? What are you gonna do? You know, she's fine. So that's what I got. Al, what did you get?
I have the grand gesture of building a beautiful garden on her rooftop.
Yes.
I have instead of dead parents, Mark Ruffalo has a dead wife.
1,000%.
I have perfect sexy circumstance. We have to solve this mystery together so you'll stop bothering me in my apartment. So we'll spend a lot of time together where I get to know you and I get to dig into your past and find out who you were. Oh, you were a thoughtful doctor, Elizabeth, and you have a lovely sister and you're a great aunt. Wow. I'm in love with you. I have enemies to lovers. At first, they're butting heads. They're both living in the same apartment. And, you know, there's that really fun montage, the median montage. or media montage. And then I have, there's a lot of, I don't think the word destiny is ever said.
I had the or same mentioned, thought,
but I wrote the- like magical flyer of destiny. Just like it's in the air, this kind of like we're meant to be together, you know.
Yeah.
The reason why I'm still around is because I what's the line? It's like
unfinished business.
Unfinished business is you. So there's kind of like this romantic, magical element to it. And then I have, instead of a bad dating montage, it's a bad apartment hunting montage. He goes to a bunch of apartments, and on everyone he goes, bad couch. This couch isn't good. This couch isn't good. And then finally he goes to the last apartment. This couch is just right.
Yeah.
I think that's it. I think that's all I have.
Okay, incredible. I'm adding there's an 8-year age gap between them. So I'm just gonna add, you know, classic mm-hmm. I'm gonna cast a male almost a decade older, pretend they're peers.
There's yes. they say the title of the movie in the opening song. The opening song is yes, just like it plays just like heaven. It caused me traumatic flashbacks I'm to so my sorry, breakup. I'm kidding.
How dare I'm so upset that that person would just burn that song that way.
I know.
For everyone, Allie's ex-boyfriend.
I think he was really nervous. And so he was like, how do I? And so he like played this song and then he like built up to it.
Break up there. Yeah. But still.
But yeah.
Oh my God. Well, little did he know that several years later, that would bring us to 17 tropes. Oh. 17 tropes. Wow. Medium to high, pretty medium for a big studio rom-com.
I know. Really, but it is like a little bit different in structure. The fact that she is dead for most
ghost.
Of it. Yeah.
It is a twist ghost. In the genre.
Yeah.
And speaking of a twist on the genre, now it's time to rate this rom-com. We here at PSA Love Rom-Coms have an ever-changing list of top 5 rom-coms. And as of now, our top 5 are The Best Man, When Harry Met Sally, Love and Basketball, The Wedding Singer, and 10 Things I Hate About You. Now, if we so choose today, we can put Just Like Heaven on that list, but we have to unanimously agree to vote off one of those other top 5 to replace it with. So what do we think? Does Just Like Heaven deserve a spot on the top 5 list? And if so, who should it knock off?
It's interesting.
Yes,
because like it is different. It's different than the typical one,
because it's
deals a twist. With ghosts, comas. The thing though is, you know, it's got everything that I would like. But maybe, and I like the two actors and I like their performance, but I'm not feeling that like off the charts chemistry. You know what I mean? Like the
1,000%.
The chemistry where I'm just like, these people are in love. And if they're not together, I will be broken. Like,
yes, there's not that moment like in, like just the one you were channeling, like in
How to Lose a
Guy in 10 Days, where Andy and Ben have that moment in the bathroom where you really the chemistry and the love, and you're like, if these people don't end up together, I'm going to scream. Or like Robbie and Julia in The Wedding Singer, or Heath Ledger and Julia Stiles in 10 Things I Hate About You, or Harry and Sally, or Love at Basketball. Yeah, it's just, I agree with you. It's, they don't, the chemistry between the leads doesn't quite add up.
Yeah. And me, because it's a ghost, so there's not a lot of like real, you know,
physical
stuff that they can do. But I felt like, compared to the other on our top 5, it just doesn't get there for me in terms of romance, and also in terms of comedy. Like, it just, you know, some of these other ones, like 10 Things I Hate About You is a freaking joke machine. Every single line, even the lines that background characters say, are just some of the funniest goddamn jokes I've ever heard.
You're so Right. Oh my God. Cause you have the best friend, David Krumholtz, Michael. You have like the teacher. Like there are so many good moments in that film.
You have like, the coffee. You have the coffee drinkers who, you know, Cameron bumps into one and they go, "That was Costa Rican butthead." Yes. And they're like, yes. It's just
there's not a wasted moment in that film.
Yeah.
And then this it gets a little lazy in places with the like, oh, she's just an oversexed booby neighbor who we hate. You know, it just gets a little it's a little nonspecific. It's a little dated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just another dumb slut.
Exactly. Exactly. Which is when you have similar movies that even from a similar time. So you can't even claim that that's the reason it does. It's just as works of art, as individual pieces of art. There are some that pop more and have a lot more texture. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to agree with you there, Al.
So
Just Like Heaven does not make it on the top five list, but it was a delightful watch. And you know what? I would absolutely do this as a laundry rom-com.
Oh, yeah.
Taxi rom-com. I would do this as like, I'm sick and I can't focus super well. It's like, it's a lovely, lovely, simple rom-com from a time where we were spending good money on rom-coms.
Yeah.
Besides the, you know, the green screen.
Now, I think it's time for a reality check. In this segment, we test out the tropes and plot devices in the rom-coms we've just watched and see if they hold up in the real world. In this film, the trope of destiny/magic that brings our two leads together is one we see throughout the film. Before Elizabeth enters into her coma, she was supposed to meet with David on a blind date. And what I'm wondering is if either one of us has ever had a similar kind of missed connection moment where we think we could have maybe met someone who might have been something more.
Oh my God. Yes. I was in college. Okay. When I was in college, this guy that I worked with was like, we were going to like, we like both kind of spoke Spanish and he was like, had pitched this thing where he was like, oh, why don't we meet at this cafe and just like speak Spanish? And, yeah. And I was
so
like,
romantic.
Yeah, I know. And I was like, oh my gosh, ooh la la, let's do it. And so I went to the cafe at the time we were supposed to meet. And I just didn't see him. And I like the cafe had like there was like a left side, there was a right side, and there was a back patio. And I like waited. I think I ended up just staying there and working on stuff because he wasn't there. And then I want to say like weeks later, he like messaged me in Spanish and was like, where were you? I waited for you at the cafe. I didn't see you. And I was like, wait, I didn't see you. And it was like this misconnection where we both were there, but just like couldn't see each other. But then like, honestly, like a long time later, I had like heard some stuff through mutual friends where I was kind of like, okay, I'm not too sad that I missed that date actually. So it was a missed connection, but it kind of, I felt like I was like, oh, that kind of happened. I'm glad that it sort of worked out the way it did. So it was a missed connection, but I was like, well, it kind of happened. I feel okay about that. So yeah. I'm cool with my missed connections now. I'm like, you know what? If I missed it, I won't miss what's meant for me. Wasn't meant for me.
Yeah.
So that's how I feel about that.
That's good. That's very healthy and also very, you know, healing too. It's good closure when you find out like, oh, okay. It's probably okay.
Yeah.
That I missed.
Exactly. But what about you, Al? Have you had a missed connections moment?
Yeah. Mine's not as romantic as that. It was just like a couple of months ago, every now and then I'll treat myself and I'll walk to Dunkin' Donuts and I'll get myself a bunch of hash browns and donuts and coffee and whatever I'm in the mood for. And I was doing like a little Dunkin' Donuts walk, and on the way to Dunkin' Donuts, I walked by this barbershop that I never noticed before, and in the window there's just like some of the most beautiful like antique barbershop chairs, and I was like, these are awesome, man. I would love to just like sit in one of the, because they were in the window and they're like kind of like part of the window display. It's like, man, it'd be just so fun to just like sit in one of those chairs. And then I went to Dunkin' Donuts and I got my hash browns and coffee. And then I started walking home and I walked past the barbershop, and on the way back, one of the most handsome men I have ever seen was sitting in one of those barber chairs, and on his lap was a fluffy little white dog. And there's just something about this man. And he was like thinking really hard about something. And this white fluffy dog, where I was like, it felt like I like knew him. And maybe I just wanted to feel like I knew him because he was so handsome. But I was like, whoa. So much so that I like walked, and then I had to look back because I was like, this man was so handsome. I have to do like a look back. And when I looked back, he was looking at me. And then I walked a little further, and then I did a second look back, and he was looking at me and smiling. And if I just had maybe been wearing a little bit more makeup that day, or feeling a little bit bolder, I would have stopped and been like, hey, this is crazy, you know, want to cut my hair sometime? But I didn't. I just kept walking. But it was like crazy. I felt like a real intense connection. And it could have just been that I was hyped on Dunkin' Donuts coffee and greasy hash browns. And I was like really just, you know, feeling that kind of crazy endorphin rush that comes with eating Dunkin' Donuts and walking fast. But really magical. And now every time I walk past that barbershop, I'm always like, is he there? Is he there? So, yeah.
No, no, I'm believe in that stuff. I believe that like sometimes you just see someone and you're like, uh-oh, I get you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm fully on board for that misconnection as being a real one. And Ali, I will personally walk you back to the barber shop to investigate further.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, and it sounds like it sounds like that checks out. Misconnections do happen. Sometimes they happen for a reason. Sometimes we don't know and we have to go back to the barbershop to investigate.
Investigate and get a little hair trim.
A little hair trim. We both end up with like little page boy haircuts. Me like, he wasn't here.
He wasn't here. And then we just have super short hair while we try to find my soulmate. We love it.
We're out to Los Angeles with our short haircuts. And while you're doing that, thank you all for listening to the pod. We have a new episode out every week. And remember to subscribe and rate. And we are brought to you by the lovely people at Campfire Media.
And P.S. I love rom-coms.
I love rom-coms.
I'm Brian Husky. I'm bald.
And I'm Charlie Sanders, and I'm also bald. And we host Bald Talk on the Campfire Media Network.
Bald Talk is the podcast where two bald comedians talk to anyone bald about being bald.
But this show isn't just for baldies, Brian. Harrows will love it too.
Bald Talk gets into vulnerability, vanity, insecurity, and self-acceptance, reminding us that we all have our respective bald spots. Not that bald spots are a bad thing.
No way. I mean, my entire head is one big bald spot.
It is one huge, beautiful bald spot, Charlie.
Get Bald Talk on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I mean, I have like a little bit of hair, but not like you. Like, you're really bald.
I'm truly bald.
Great. I mean, it's
I'm
great.
I'm balder than it. You.
You are balder than me. Only on Bald Talk. Campfire.